Are law enforcement agencies as a whole doing enough to crack down on internet crimes, from child pornography to email scams? Or do we police the internet too much? I'm Joy Cardine, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are going to explore the history of the effort to prevent and solve crimes on the internet with the author of The Internet Police, How Crime Went Online and the Cops Followed. And we will welcome your questions and your own stories. Have you ever been the victim of internet crime? Are you okay with the police presence as it is on the web? Or do you think that we police the internet too much? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Nate Anderson, deputy editor for Ars Technica. His work has been published in The Economist and Foreign Policy. He is the author of The Internet Police, How Crime Went Online and the Cops Followed. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, so how and when did crime go online?
Well, you know, it really happened as soon as people started using the internet. So for many years, the internet was used only by researchers, engineers, some government agencies. And then in the early 90s, it started to become mainstream. And by the end of the 90s, it was fully mainstream. And crime began almost immediately. And what you had back in the 90s was a lot of pronouncements about how the internet was going to lead to this incredible revolution in freedom. You know, anybody can publish anything without a printing press. We can email anyone all over the world. We can buy anything from all over the world. But you also got these predictions that crime would flourish. There'd be no way to find people, right? How are you going to find somebody who's living in a hut in some foreign country? You know, what are you going to do if somebody puts a child pornography server up in a country where the authorities don't care? You know, and so there was a real sense that there's going to be an internet crime wave, and there's going to be absolutely nothing we can do to stop it. And it took law enforcement quite a while to realize that's not true. And they learned a lot of new techniques. There's a whole new generation of police officers and FBI agents now who have kind of come into the ranks. And we found out that that's really not true at all. And crime can actually be policed pretty well.
Now, we'll talk a little bit about that. But what did the earliest cyber crimes look like?
Well, one of the earliest was spam. I mean, before the internet was even commercialized, this had already started, and it's something that has afflicted people to this day and shows no signs of going away. But what you saw over time was this became increasingly more sophisticated. As police started cracking down on people, they had to get more serious about what they were doing. And so what you see today is that the biggest criminal activity on the web is run by, you know, actual criminal enterprises that have a lot of similarities to organized crime, like the mafia, so more traditional forms.
Well, what are some of those major offenses?
So some of the big ones are carding, it's called, stealing and using people's credit cards, identity theft, child pornography, spam, viruses, hacking on behalf of nation states or corporations to steal secrets has been a huge one recently. So those are some of the biggies, but basically everything you can find offline has gone online.
So in what ways did the internet expand old crimes as opposed to creating new ones?
Well, I think most of these crimes were possible before, but they often required people to be in physical proximity, which really limited them. So, for instance, child pornography. So some of the prosecutors I've talked to have noted that they think they had this issue almost under control about 15 years ago in the offline world, because it was very hard for people interested in that to meet up with each other, to find safe places to exchange material. And the internet blew that back open again just because of how easy it is to meet up, how easy it is for niche groups to find others who share their interests anywhere in the world now. And so that's led to a real explosion again in something that they thought they had kind of a handle on.
So what were the early days of policing the internet like?
Well, you get a lot of attempts to do things, but you also get a lot of hand-wringing about resources. You say there are people, you know, there are millions of people all over the world who can do bad things, and then there's local police in one town. The bad things might be happening to the residents of their town, and they simply don't have the resources to, you know, deal with all these potential threats that they are now exposed to. So you even had federal court cases where, you know, judges were basically throwing up their hands and saying, hey, we can't police the internet, and even trying to create laws to do so is not going to work.
But so then at what point did law enforcement realize that they needed to and took a different approach?
So in the early, well, I'd say late 1990s, early 2000s, they realized that things were getting sort of out of control, that if they didn't figure out how to catch people, it was going to become a total free-for-all. And so there was a big investment of resources, of training. The FBI set up a cybercrime bureau. Local police offices all over the country, including in my town, now have detectives who specialize in online crime. And so once you put that many people on the issue, they began to find ways that you could identify these people online. And, you know, it turned out not to be as easy to hide as people used to think it was. I mean, sure, if you're still a great hacker who's part of a criminal gang living in Eastern Europe, you're probably pretty safe. But most people aren't that good at it, and so they do get found fairly easily.
How come I still get more spam or scam emails than I get legit ones?
Well, that is part of the evolution of spam. Has been fascinating because at each step to police it, the spammers have gotten more creative, harder to find. They've buried themselves in more layers of bureaucracy, and the spam epidemic is now like, you know, any major commercial operation. There are people who do nothing but specialize in taking over the computers of millions of unsuspecting users around the world and turning those computers into something called a botnet, which they can then send out commands to distribute the spam. So they don't write the spam. They don't take any orders or any money from the people who receive the spam. They are purely distributors. So that is how specialized the industry has gotten. And they have learned what parts of the globe won't do things to catch them. So, for instance, a number of these guys, one of the cases I talk about in the book, the guy comes from Russia, which is where many of these guys are from. There's a lot of education. There's enough infrastructure. But Russia doesn't show a lot of interest in stopping people whose crimes are mainly directed outside the country, and Russia refuses to extradite any of its citizens for any reason. So law enforcement is really kind of stuck. It can find these people. It just can't get them. And so what it had to do in this case was wait till this young guy decided he was going to visit a Las Vegas car show, thinking he'd be okay to do that, and they grabbed him in Las Vegas when he got off the plane.
What are the criminals getting out of these spams? I mean, people are responding to this stuff and sending money to the Nigerian princes or whoever.
It seems unbelievable, doesn't it? But yes. I mean, the great thing about the internet from their perspective is how many people you can reach, because response rates are so almost unbelievably low. Very few people click on it. But when you've contacted 2 million people, you know, that turns out to be good enough. Like, this guy I was profiling in the book was, I think, 23 at the time. He made $470,000 in 6 months in 2007 just from one client who wanted him to distribute their spam. So there's quite a bit of money to be made if you know what you're doing.
And is there any hope that one day I will just have legit emails in my inbox?
There is hope, but right now it's a faint hope. Spam has been holding steady and maybe slightly declining in recent years, but it looks like something that'll be with us for a long time. And in part, that's because email is free to deliver, you know, which is one of the reasons why you don't get the same volume of spam in your regular mail. It just costs too much money, and the low response rates don't make up for that.
Yeah. So where has law enforcement had more success in cracking down on internet criminals?
So it turns out that one of the fears was that all these guys who wanted to do bad things would go to countries that didn't seem to care, they'd set up shop there, and there would basically be no way to reach them. But it turns out that most people don't do that. It's a lot of work to relocate to a country like Russia. Most people aren't going to do that. And so what they found is, you know, most criminals are pretty easy to get. And the other thing they learned is that international cooperation goes a long way. So in the child pornography bust I detail in the book, the case begins in Australia when local police, just doing a raid on somebody's house, find a video of child sex abuse on his computer. They identify the speakers as speaking with a Flemish accent, send the file to Belgian police. Belgian police actually find the guy in the video, who is a dad abusing his two daughters. They tie him to a studio in Ukraine, which was run by an Italian. The Italian police arrest that guy. They get his emails, the email of his clients. Those email addresses of the clients are sent to European police departments, which execute raids in over 20 countries. The U.S. emails go to the U.S., which eventually in 2008 cracks down on what was the largest child pornography ring discovered to date. So, you know, the criminals may be international, but the police have finally learned to be international as well. They're doing a lot more cooperation, information sharing, and, you know, that really eliminates this huge advantage that many of the people involved in criminal activity thought they had 10 years ago, because they could move across borders and the police couldn't get them. But it turns out cooperation goes a long way to getting most of those people.
We are talking about the evolution of policing on the internet and the history of the effort to solve and prevent internet crimes. And we welcome your thoughts, your questions, your experiences. Have you ever been the victim of internet crime? Was law enforcement able to help you sufficiently? Do you think that law enforcement agencies as a whole are doing enough to crack down on online crimes? Or maybe you think we police the internet too much? Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about policing the internet and spying on the internet. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll wonder if you think that greater security is worth it, worth the collection of personal information that's online, our own personal information by the police, or maybe even the NSA. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Nate Anderson, who is the author of The Internet Police, How Crime Went Online and the Cops Followed. And we welcome your questions. We welcome your experiences. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Do you think that we police the internet enough? Or too much? Nate, I wanted to ask you how the NSA and its information gathering tools fit into this discussion.
Yeah, that's been a great question this summer as we've seen all these revelations come out about what they're really capable of. And I think it just shows you what is truly possible when the gloves come off. I mean, the NSA operates under rules, but far, far fewer than, you know, the police operations like the FBI and local agents that I talk about in the book, which, you know, can be scary enough at times. You know, they do great things, but you really have to make sure that things are under control. One of the cases I talk about is just a case where a substitute teacher in Ohio is sitting in her apartment one day. Local cops come knocking on her door. They have printouts of her, you know, topless, engaged in webcam chats over the computer with her boyfriend. I mean, this is the kind of thing that is increasingly possible for all, you know, aspects of law enforcement. So you can imagine when that kind of power to look at what people are doing privately with their computers has many of these rules taken away, when broad-based data collection is more possible. So I think it's really sparked a great debate about what the limits should be in the quest to crack down on some of these crimes, because their capabilities are certainly amazing.
I'm taking my jaw off the radio board right now. The police had videos of this woman topless conducting web chats with her boyfriend. Why in the world did they have that?
Yeah, well, that's a crazy story. They had it because the woman had bought a laptop from a student who she taught. Laptop turned out to be stolen. It had belonged to the school district. The school district, in order to keep track of them in case they were stolen, had installed this remote administration software on them, which allowed the district to watch the webcam, you know, to see who was sitting in front of the computer, or listen to its microphone, or look at the files or the websites that somebody was browsing using the computer. So when that computer was reported stolen, they turned those things on, and the private company they hired to help them retrieve it basically accessed her computer, looked at her on the webcam, took screenshots of this, sent them to local police, who decided it'd be a great idea to print these out and take them with them when they went to knock on her door. And they eventually ended up arresting her. The whole thing became kind of a fiasco. The local prosecutor dropped the charges, and then she sued the police department for harassing her. So, crazy story, but it's just a reminder of just how much your privacy can be invaded when you bring something as simple as a laptop into the center of your home and store your most personal documents and use it for your most personal communications, because unless people really know what they're doing, it is not secure.
Well, so back to the NSA, though. How would the NSA's collection of data be any different than, you know, the Madison Police Department if it was looking into potential criminal activity that I was up to?
Well, the Madison Police Department has to go to a judge. They've got to get warrants, or they have to issue subpoenas to companies like Google or Facebook, say, to get your email. So that is, in most cases, more supervised. There's a legal process, and they're more limited in what they can get. The NSA is not operating under that sort of a paradigm. If it needs a warrant at all, it goes to a secret court where the decisions are not public, and it gets broad-based warrants, not necessarily just warrants for, we want the email for one person, but they receive broad authority to set up things like internet taps on the fiber optic backbones of the internet. They go to companies like AT&T, who control most of the internet data passing in and out of the U.S., and they have apparently gotten them to voluntarily provide copies of that data as it flows through the wires. I mean, the scale is so different as to make those two things almost entirely different. I mean, the NSA can see most of the traffic, it sounds like, passing out of the U.S. on the internet. I mean, local police might be investigating one person in one place at one time and under the public supervision of a judge most often.
Yeah. I know you don't concentrate on the NSA situation in the book, but how do you think this is going to affect the future of our relationship with the internet?
Well, I think it's helped to wake people up to the fact that, you know, you don't have as much privacy and anonymity online as you thought, and national governments are pretty intent on not letting you keep the privacy you have now. It's not just hackers. It's also nation states. And we also saw this last week that Miss Teen USA announced that her webcam had been hacked last year. Somebody had taken pictures of her in her bedroom through her camera and then tried to extort her with those. And she's using her year as Miss Teen USA to try to educate teens about these issues. So you take those two things together, and I think they're really going to help wake people up to the possibilities of what can happen both from traditional bad guys, but also from nation states that want to keep an eye on what people are doing. So in that sense, I think it's going to be a really positive debate for people, and it's something everybody growing up in this new digital age really needs to be aware of.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Nate Anderson. He is the author of The Internet Police, How Crime Went Online and the Cops Followed. And we welcome your input on this conversation as we talk about the evolution of policing on the internet. And we wonder if you think that the internet is policed enough or too much. or maybe you have a story of some sort of internet crime that was perpetrated against you. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, let's talk a little bit about what is being done to prevent cybercrime. We've talked about trying to track down the bad guys. What's happening to prevent it, Nate Anderson?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, in many cases, crime tends to be prosecuted after it has happened. But there are some attempts, it depends on the crime, to stop things or to, I guess, lure people out before they can do worse things. So one of the things that I've been covering recently has been police attempts across the nation to find sexual predators who are interested in sex with underage girls. And what they will do is they will set up major operations. Sometimes they will invite other local police departments over for a couple of days, and they'll get a bunch of investigators in a room. They'll often go to a site like Craigslist, which millions of people use for posting classified ads and finding things to buy. And they will start posting in some of the adult sections of that site. When they get people who respond, they say, hey, I'm really only 14, and they try to get those people to come to a designated address. And if they do, they arrest them. This has been hugely controversial. Some judges are calling it entrapment, but it's one of the ways in which police are trying to use the internet to sort of lure out those who might be doing things they don't want before those things actually happen.
So, Nate, are you working on the roof right now?
I'm sorry, there is some construction right next to me here.
That's what I figured. All right. No, just explaining that to our listeners, what they're hearing.
Yeah,
in the background.
Sorry, I can't relocate.
No, it's okay.
I would.
It's okay. Also, what about companies like Norton or Kaspersky, the two leading internet security companies protecting against viruses and hackers? Are police working with those companies to help keep bad stuff from happening in the first place?
Well, it's hard to say, and it depends, I guess, which agencies you mean, because the police have a complicated relationship with those groups. So many elements of the U.S. government, for instance, would want Americans' computers to be safeguarded. They would like them to avoid, hackers, gangs out of Eastern Europe, Chinese state-sponsored hacking. And so they encourage security. They want these firms to do a good job. They want people to use their products. But other parts of the U.S. government don't want that kind of security because it tends to spread around the world, and they would prefer to be able to hack into computers that control Iranian centrifuges, for instance. So you have kind of the government working at cross purposes on some of these things where, it would like to preserve its ability to hack into a wide range of computers, and making things too secure is sort of bad for business. For operations like the Defense Department and the NSA. So, even the NSA, though, is also involved in helping American businesses secure their networks. Even as all these revelations come out about how it prefers to, investigate and hack into other, companies and countries as well. So it's one of these situations where you just have different parts of the government working almost against each other, and I think trying to find a balance that they're comfortable with.
Let's go to the phones. Linda in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Linda.
Hi. I would like to ask kind of two different questions here. My computer sent me an email from a doctor's office that I'm very familiar with, and when I answered it, I got a series of really horrible pictures as far as sexual-type pictures, and my computer just blew up and kind of died, which cost me money to get it fixed. What did they get out of that? They didn't ask me for any money. It wasn't anything like that. Is this just some kind of a sick thing that they derive pleasure in? And my second question, and I'll take this off the air, is how safe is it to pay your bills through a bank online? Thank you for your help.
All right, so she clicks on an email that she thinks is from her doctor's office and gets some porn. Why was that sent to her?
It's hard to say what could have been going on there without seeing it. They may have been trying to get her to sign up for some kind of adult dating service or some pornographic website. They could have been in some complicated scam to generate advertising dollars for the spammer by displaying these pictures or videos to more people. You know, it's hard to know. There's so many varieties of this scam that it's hard to say. But she's right that one of the most common techniques for getting people to trust emails is make them look like they're from somebody who you already know, and then people do tend to open them, click on them, respond to them. And there are many different ways that that can happen. But yes, it's certainly wise to be skeptical. And I think once pornography started coming back, you can definitely be sure that was not from your doctor.
Yeah. And before we go on to her other question, though, she says her computer blew up just like that. So this also was intended, or there are some viruses like that that are just intending to shut you down?
Well, again, it's hard to say because there are just so many, but mm-hmm. there are many cases in which someone will get a virus on their computer. The virus itself will display a lot of pornography, often as a way of somehow making money through these kind of complicated back-end advertising and affiliate deals. And sometimes they bog down your computer because they're badly written. Maybe they've taken over your computer and they're using it to send out thousands of spam messages an hour, silently. You don't notice, but they're going out from your computer, and all that work slows your computer down. So they can do a lot of things that really do bog your computer down. It's not usually the goal of the software. It's just a side effect of whatever scam they're running.
And isn't that, I had heard that one of the goals of those emails from the scam doctor's office or bank or whatever else, I know there are, some of them want your personal information, but I thought that one of the goals was just to get your email somehow so they could send out more of these. Supposedly then my friends would get this email from me and open it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely one way that they used to harvest addresses. I'm not sure that's as common anymore because it's so easy to buy lists of millions mm-hmm. and millions of email addresses, right now, that you almost don't need to do that for that reason anymore. The reason you tend to get them from banks most commonly is because they're engaged in something called phishing. That's phishing with a PH at the beginning, in which they're basically just seeking your account credentials. And they'll trick you to go to a page that looks almost exactly like your bank's page. You would enter your password and your username, and suddenly who's ever on the receiving end of that could log into your account, transfer money out of it, etc. That's not so common with the doctor's office. So I think this was just one of those scams where they were using an address they knew she had responded to in the past or received email from in the past in order to make it look more plausible and get her to reply or click on a link or something.
And speaking of banks, she wonders if online banking is safe.
It's surprising. The banks don't go public, I think for reasons we can all understand, with some of the things that happen to them. So it is hard to say exactly how secure they are. But, there have not been too many major incidents of banks being massively hacked, of losing money. Certainly if they do, they keep the losses to themselves. They don't affect individual bank accounts. Most banks are pretty good about this issue when it comes to fraudulent charges. The one thing people really need to watch out for is because of these problems with email, banks will essentially never email you or never ask you to click on something in an email. So most banks now, if they need to send a message to you, make you log into your account and the message is there in some sort of message center that the bank runs because they cannot trust email. So, as long as you don't click on emails from or about your bank, you're fairly safe. Banks seem to be doing a pretty good job.
We are talking about policing crime on the internet. I'm talking about prevention and law enforcement of crimes on the web, and welcoming your questions for our guest, welcoming your own examples, wondering if you have a view on whether we police the internet too much or not enough. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Are you concerned about your privacy online. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking with Nate Anderson. He is the author of The Internet Police, How Crime Went Online and the Cops Followed. Nate is also deputy editor for Ars Technica. His work has been published in other publications as well, talking about the past, present, and future of policing the internet. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, let's talk a little bit about the recording industry's crackdown in the early 2000s involving people that were illegally sharing music files through programs like Napster. How were these users tracked down, and how big a deal is illegal file sharing today?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it gets to one of the reasons that people aren't quite as anonymous as they used to think they were online, and it's that people really do leave a trail. Your computer has something called an IP address, an Internet Protocol address, that can be traced back to you with the help of your Internet provider. And so what the recording industry was doing was they would start going onto these file sharing sites where millions of songs were available, places like Napster, but many, many others as well. And because these sites needed a way to put users in touch with each other to exchange the songs, the users had to be able to see the IP address of the other computer they were connected to, and the recording industry could see them as well. So it really just began vacuuming up lists of hundreds of thousands of IP addresses. It would take people who are sharing the most songs to court. It sued, I think, about 18 to 20,000 people in the middle of the last decade. And it would get subpoenas from the judge to go to their internet provider, who would tell them, here was the subscriber on that account at that time. And then they would sue that person and ask them to settle for $3,000, $4,000, or they would take the case to court. So it began this long process of going after, music fans who were sharing these files online. Eventually it became so costly just in terms of all these legal fees. The recording industry was losing money on this campaign. They were generating horrific publicity because, of course, just knowing what computer was used doesn't tell you who was at the computer at the time. And for various technical reasons, sometimes these identifications could be wrong. And so, even getting a few people wrong and going after, elderly grandmothers who were accused of downloading gangster rap just generated these terrible headlines. And so eventually they gave up on the entire scheme and are essentially suing no individuals anymore over this issue. In years of doing this and going after almost 20,000 people, only two people went all the way through the judicial process and had a trial and went to court and before a jury. So it was quite a process. Today, it's hard to say how big the problem is. Things have gotten a lot better because there are much, much better legal options out there that didn't exist a few years ago. So if you want access to 13 million songs right now, you can pay like $9 a month to several different providers and listen to any of them, and it's easier than finding those songs on these file sharing networks. So, at this point, you really, really have to be kind of a cheapskate or really looking for something that's out of the ordinary in order to want to keep pirating music, because it has become so easy, and I think that's reduced a lot of the piracy that they used to worry so much about.
Well, this is a slightly different twist on cybercrime, but in Madison, we have had a rash of iPhone robberies. People are being told to keep your phone, in your pocket or in your purse and not walk around with it, glued to your ear or in your hand. And I know when I purchased my iPhone recently, I was told that, this is the number one stolen item or something, and that I should take out insurance on it. Can you talk a little bit about, why these things are in such demand, and what police are doing about that?
Yeah, I mean, the police in New York issued an advisory a few months ago saying that this was had become one of the biggest crimes in all the five boroughs of New York. Mm-hmm. And in part, it's because people don't realize it often because they're only paying $100 or $200 for these phones. But the phones are worth $600 on average for a good smartphone, sometimes $700. It's hard to find people who are carrying around $700 in cash all the time. But it's easy to find people who are carrying around $700 smartphones, who are using them in public. You know, it is a different world from trying to grab that much in cash, and it's easier for people. So they've become quite a target. I mean, the good news is that the phones themselves have gotten better, the software has gotten better, and it's easy to track them down. When my parents, who live in Wisconsin, were burglarized a year and a half ago, the burglar was located at a local McDonald's because he had also stolen someone's iPad, and the police were able to get a fix on its location as to where it was, and they went and arrested this guy. So there are tools now to counteract some of this, but yeah, it's still a huge problem.
Well, I didn't know that your parents were in Wisconsin. Where are they?
Down in Kenosha.
All right. Well, hello to Nate's parents. Let's go to Jason in Sturgeon Bay, who's been waiting. Hello, Jason.
Yeah, I had a question. When I was at the gas station yesterday, I used a credit card at the pump, and apparently my credit card number was stolen while I used it at the pump, and then throughout the day, charges were made to my credit card, and my bank caught it. But I'm wondering how this happens, and what are other ways that credit cards are being stolen, or what are the most popular ways in which credit cards are being stolen today?
Well, that's a great question. And again, it's hard to say what exactly did happen, but one of the most common scenarios when you hear something like that is something called skimming. And what thieves will do, they can buy these very, very sophisticated overlays. So when you go up to a gas station or ATM, you know, there's that slot in which you have to insert your card and pull it back out. Well, what these thieves will do is they can actually put their own slot right over the one that's there. It lines up exactly with it. So your card still goes in and still triggers, you know, the actual mechanism, but it also passes over a tiny reader that the thieves have installed. It's powered by just a tiny little battery. They can usually come back and pick it up a few days later, or some of these things will have tiny radio transmitters in them, and the thieves can show up nearby in a car, open a laptop, you know, offload the data without actually having to walk back to the machine and risk exposure. So this is called skimming. It's become increasingly common at gas pumps and ATMs. It's a good way to get a bunch of credit cards, and, you know, thieves know they have to use them quickly now because of banks are getting pretty good about spotting those kind of patterns. So that may have been what happened to you, and it can be hard. I mean, even seasoned professionals sometimes have trouble identifying these things if they're put on really, really well. So I guess the best advice is just, you know, keep an eye out for anything unusual when you insert your card into a slot. Anything that looks off or feels wrong or seems too big or looks like something's been added on, maybe try a different machine if that's the case.
Jason, sorry that happened to you. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Zach in Hartford. Hi, Zach.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what you think the future of websites like the Silk Road might be, as well as services like Bitcoin.
Well, first of all, what's the Silk Road, Nate?
So the Silk Road is a site where people can go online. It's a bit like eBay. They can buy almost any drug imaginable in the world, have it shipped to their home. They can leave feedback on the product and on the seller and their service. You know, and you can see the feedback that others have left. You can know if you want to trust this merchant or not. And they use something called Bitcoin to handle their payments. It's a purely electronic currency that was designed with anonymity in mind, very, very difficult to trace. So they've been around for 2 years and are the largest such site that we know about. They appear to be quite profitable, and I think Forbes had an interview just last week with the guy behind the site who goes by the name Dread Pirate Roberts. So, you know, as for the future, it's hard to say. The reason the site is able to exist is because it uses software called Tor, which was originally developed ironically, by the U.S. Navy to keep its communications private, and turns out to work remarkably well for keeping any communications private. So you have to use Tor as a user. You install the software. It's free to download. You put it on your computer, and then you can visit the Silk Road. The Silk Road, in turn, runs Tor. And it's very difficult for law enforcement to find out who's actually behind it, where the server is. Are they going to be able to? My guess is if they really wanted to expend the effort, they could. We've seen some recent cases in the last few months where Tor appears to have been compromised, or at least parts of the network. And, you know, with some of the revelations about how the NSA works, about how they give special focus to anything that's encrypted, as Tor is, you know, I suspect they could get this guy if they really wanted, but it would probably be a significant effort. I mean, he's been going for 2 years, basically agitating law enforcement. I mean, senators have spoken out about this particular site, and it's still not shut down. So, you know, I don't want to speculate too much. I mean, this guy may have a really good setup that has just proven almost impossible to penetrate. And I think we'll just have to wait and see how this develops. Busting people who run these hidden sites on the Tor network is rather a new thing and is still pretty unusual.
Zach, thank you for the call. Here's an email from Jessica, who writes, "The challenge with digital crimes is that the perpetrators may be located anywhere. Whose responsibility is it to prosecute these crimes? What happens when it crosses international borders and all the laws that govern behavior may be different in that country where the criminals live?"
Yeah, and that is a great question, because that was the great fear about 10 years ago, right? So how are we going to be able to stop these people? But it turns out that the U.S. has a lot of friends in the world, and most of those are countries where a lot of people would prefer to live or to vacation. And it is, you know, there aren't that many people who can stay out of those places indefinitely. If you can, for instance, if you operate out of Russia, which will not extradite you, yes, you are safe from U.S. law unless the U.S. can convince the Russians to arrest you. But most people live in friendly countries to the U.S., or they travel through them. So the U.S. Federal agents busted a guy who was involved in a credit card scamming ring. I believe he was Estonian, lived right near the Russian border. The Estonians would not, for some reason, arrest and extradite him, so they just waited. He passed through Germany without ever crossing into German territory. He was on his way to Indonesia, but he was in transit through a German airport, and the Germans went in and arrested him on behalf of the Americans, shipped him off to the U.S., and he's now in a jail after being tried in New York. So, you know, it's not quite the Wild West, it seems. Extradition, international cooperation, and, you know, the lure of people who make a lot of money who want to go to places like New York or Las Vegas or London or Paris is pretty great. And it's increasingly hard in the modern world not to pass through at least one of the places where a country like the U.S. can exert influence.
Thanks to Jessica. Next we go to Andy in Platteville. Hello, Andy.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
I recently got a new credit card. I decided to go out online and set it up so that I could track the activity online. After entering all my information, I found out, when it didn't take it, I found out I was on the wrong website. The one that I was supposed to be on was like Bank Corp Online without a K in it, and I typed in Bank Corp Online with a K in it. So did I just give up all my vital information to some unreputable outfit, and how do I find out? You know, how do I find out what I did?
Yeah, it's possible. I would definitely check with the credit card issuer to see if there's any fraudulent charges on the account. You might just tell them what happened and, just for precaution's sake, have them issue another one with a new number, which should protect you. That is, unfortunately, a really common thing. That's the way most of these spammers who send emails from their bank operate. You know, many of the sites are named so that if you're not looking really closely, you might think you're going to your bank. And it's a great tactic for exactly that reason. And so they will snap up all these domain names that sound very, very similar or that are one letter off or that have a slightly different suffix, so .net instead of .com. And many people, you know, you're in a hurry, you don't notice. So it has been a great technique. People are trying to crack down on this, but it's a tough problem to solve, because who decides when, you know, a site, you know, when somebody registering a name is doing so for nefarious purposes and whether they just want that name. So it's been tough to crack down on, but yeah, I would definitely contact your bank. There's a good chance that you may have provided those credentials to somebody who is, you know, at this moment, adding them to a database that will be resold to other people and could be used soon.
Yeah, I'd probably get a new card too. Andy, good luck. Jenny in Winona is with us now. Hi, Jenny.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Ironically, last night we got a phone call from our bank that my daughter, myself, my husband's business, his brother's business, all were compromised. Now, my question, in which we shut everything down immediately, of course, one, we were concerned that was that caller really from the bank? And two, you had mentioned earlier about a bank will never email you, but what about e-statements? And I'll take the answer offline. Thank you.
Yeah, well, maybe I should clarify that. Banks will email you things like your statements, but what they won't do is say, please click here to change your password. Please click here to log into your account. Banks have gone to a one-way model. So they will email you things that just go to you. They don't ask you to go back to the website. Or if they do, they say, you know, go to your web browser and type in the bank's name. Because clicking links in emails has just become, you know, it's a spammer's paradise, and banks know it. Yeah, and what was the first part of the question?
I think she said they received a phone call saying that their accounts had all been compromised, and she didn't know if that was legit, and I don't know if you can know that either.
Yeah, no, hard to say, but yeah. I think the best thing, if you're ever suspicious, is just tell the bank, you know, thank you for the notice, I'll call you back in just a minute, and call the number on the back of your card, ask to be put back in touch with their fraud department, and that way you know who you're calling. Yes, you know, I've had that same experience. Somebody calls, tells you they're from a fraud department. Well, are they? So I always like to call back myself through a number I know is valid. And then if they tell me, yes, there was fraud on the account, I know I've got the right person.
Well, Nate, we only have a minute to go. What's your takeaway for our listeners?
Well, I think, you know, the takeaway is don't be paranoid about life online. It's a great place. It enables us to do so many things that weren't possible before or were difficult before. But I think just to have a real respect for the power of this technology and for the power of those who would like to violate our privacy. And I think as people get educated about that, they can take some fairly basic countermeasures that won't protect you from, you know, somebody like the NSA if they want to take a look, but can keep you out of a lot of trouble online. Because I just know I've been amazed researching this book, just what is possible for the bad guys to do.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing that and talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Nate Anderson is the author of The Internet Police, How Crime Went Online and the Cops Followed. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing this program. Thanks to Bill Martins for on-air direction. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come, and I hope you are with us tomorrow at this time when it's our Week in Review. We'll discuss the top news stories of the week, state, national, and international, during our Week in Review tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.